So this Birthing Behind Bars website is in partnership with Nation Inside. And what we've done is we have information where we like folks to first join our pledge so that we understand that Canada still shackles women during birth and delivery. So you shouldn't do that anymore. And you should fight to end that, right? There are many states that have joined in, but we have 50 states in the U.S., and only 17, 18 states no longer shackle women during birth and delivery. That's it. So we have a long fight. And so if you can imagine, we were the seventh state in 2009. It's 2013 now, right? So you know we're doing this fight state by state. And it's ridiculous. Like, can't you wrap your mind around that, you know, women should not be shackled during birth and delivery? I mean, it's just like, it's a no-brainer. But because we think that if a woman goes to prison and, you know, she's in prison, then she should be punished, and whatever happens, happens. You know, women are incarcerated and experience the same practices as men do. There's no differentiation on these practices. In fact, the five-point restraints was visualized by a person who was in prison. You know, he said, here is a better way to lock me down. And so the five-point restraint is, and this is how women are pretty much locked up when they're pregnant. It doesn't matter whether they're pregnant or not. But there's a chain that comes around their waist and their belly, and then there's a box, and their hands are here, locked up in this box. So there's a chain around their waist. And then there's a chain that goes from their wrist to their feet, and that's where the shackles are, right? So that's called a five-point restraint. So the 2 feet, the 2 wrists, and then the box in the middle is the 5 points. So when you think about that, that's dehumanizing. When you think about it, how can a woman protect herself if she's walking and she's in labor and she falls down? How can she protect herself? How can she protect herself if she's in the back of the van and, God forbid, the van gets in an accident? How can she protect herself? And this is what we were thinking about. So how do we bring some type of safety to this particular event? Understandably, this is an event for many women who bring them closer to their humanity. You know, it's a sacred moment. Why would you shackle a woman who's in labor? Like, where in the hell is she going? You know, regardless of what crime she's committed, she's not running anywhere. You know, there's just no thought of that. And in fact, we found out that during many instances when women were transported from the prison to the hospital, there were never any escapes of women who were in labor and giving birth. So no women were running away regardless. You know, so that was one of the messages that we had sent to the politicians. And the experience of women when they give birth is that they're oftentimes in the birthing room with a CO who's looking at them as they're giving birth. Their family is not notified, so they're not in a waiting room somewhere where they're waiting this announcement of this new person coming into the world, right? Where it's joyous and it's happy, right? The baby is taken from the mom and put on her chest, and if she's still handcuffed, that one hand is still attached to a chain, and she may be able to hold her baby for 2.5 minutes. For women who who give birth through C-sections, their babies are taken away from them. They're immediately shackled again, and they are sent to their hospital room, and their babies are taken to ICU. When the mothers are able to go and visit their babies, they're shackled by their ankles and one hand to the wheelchair and rolled to the ICU by the officer. And so they're in the ICU with other women who are seeing their babies in a robe with these shackles and handcuffs on. Like, where are they going? They're just so happy to be with their children. You know, they're not going to go anywhere. And so we wanted to end these particular practices because they're just terrible, for lack of a better word. And so what we did was we were able to win that in 2009 to end the shackling. We weren't able to remove. Women are still taken to prison with one handcuff, and that's attached to the chair once they're taken out of the van. And so they're in the wheelchair now with one handcuff. And then they're in the attached to the gurney with one handcuff, as opposed to being shackled during birth and delivery by the ankles. But so this is our initiative, and it's a national initiative. And what we do through our resistance is we work with women to train them who've been involved in the criminal justice system in organizing and sharing their voice, like Janet did, about her experience in prison. The best way to do organizing is to share your story of experience and to get over the fact that people see you as your experience. You know, and it's somehow hard to, as a woman, to get over that, because we carry a burden. You know, society sees us as sisters and mothers, and we're the caretakers, and we're not supposed to fall. You know, but men can do it. My grandmother used to tell me all the time, men can be in the gutter in one day and then get a suit on the next day, and people will say, wow, look at him, he's pulled himself up. But let a woman do it, and she will be that same person that she was before, and all those names, you know, and she will never be recognized as that man. And it's true. And so when we think about women and the experiences that we've had during our incarceration, it's important to be able to reframe those stories and those experiences so that we can address the shame and the guilt that comes with the experience itself. It's not without us feeling that we didn't have any other choices. The system never gave us any choice. You know, the way in which we were placed in an environment, and you know, the experiences we've had of trauma and violence has been something that we've experienced all along. It's not something that is something that, you know, was just set in place. It's what we were mostly used to. But we were able to work around it, you know. So what we did at Worth was we brought women in who had these experiences as a part of our initial conversations in assisting women and offering mutual aid to our sisters when they came home, was about having those conversations and addressing the trauma, addressing the issues of depression and sadness and stigma and, you know, what it is that a person had done. Like if they had used drugs, if they had sold their body, if they had, you know, been a part of the street economy, if they had been a mule, if they had been a person who was a spotter for a drug dealer, whatever it was, if they had left their children when they were using drugs, we addressed those real issues, you know, and talked about how the system, basically from where it was and where we were, if we couldn't get a job, if we couldn't go to school, that impacted us. We had to put food on our tables for our family. And so, you know, instead of leaving a person with all of that, we had to find things for them to do so that they could become involved and feel important and empowered. And you can't empower someone, because people come with their own power, but you can give them opportunities to kind of find that power and be able to move forward from that internalized place. So what we did was we began establishing ways in which we identified women in the criminal justice system and historically times in which women resisted. And we began sharing those stories of resistance, you know, that was happening throughout our history of incarceration. And once we began identifying those instances of resistance, we started developing the history and timeline of women impacted by the criminal justice system to identify the stats and the numbers and the increase of women going to prison and the policies that were enacted that impacted women specifically, so that we would become educated about those policies historically, that little by little grew prisons for women specifically and took us out of the world and out of our communities and out of our children's lives, so that we began to discuss that. Then we began to discuss how many years collectively we had spent in prison together. And so when you had 12 women in a room and you had every one of them telling you how much time they spent, there were times when we had 127 years of prison time in the room out of 12 women. And we talked about the loss of time and ability and asset and how much we were, you know, not able to add to our families based on the time spent collectively, how much we were unable to add to our communities based on the time spent collectively inside prison. And that impacted us, you know. And so out of all of that, we became angry. And then once you get angry, you get agitated, right? And then once you get agitated, then you start doing something. And then you have women say, oh, fuck it. I don't give a shit about what anybody says about me anymore. I've got to change this. You know, and so that's what happened. And that's what happened in those three instances. So with this initiative, we've also put together ways in which you can get women involved in doing the work. And I think it's important that you think about how do you organize formerly incarcerated women. First, you have to give folks an opportunity to share their stories and to share their stories in a meaningful way and to work with them from a place of where if they've been traumatized, you hear the trauma, that they're not sharing their stories from a place of where they're telling you what's happening to them, but that you're offering them an opportunity to share their stories in like a free writing way or a free speech way so that it doesn't seem repetitious and it doesn't re-traumatize them. So writing workshops are really good. You know, free writing. Women don't often understand the sound of their voices, right? Women of color have been scrutinized and stigmatized, and so their angry voice comes across, right? You've heard of the angry black woman syndrome. Well, their angry voices come across, and I don't believe in an angry black woman syndrome, but sometimes black women can sound really fierce and angry, and you don't know where it's coming from. It's, you know, but it's that inability to be fully self-expressed. And so the first voice that they hear, right, within themselves is one that I've got to protect myself. I've got to sound like I'm strong, right? So we did workshops where we just sounded out our voices and just heard what we sounded like, where it was just really simple with sounds, just om and ha and just breathing, you know, just to be able to hear our voices. Very simple type of participatory practices, you know, getting in touch with our conditioned reaction to things, how we've been conditioned ourselves to react to things, to touch, to people being close to us, to people being in our space, and really talking about what that means, that uncomfortability, you know, and the inability to actually be able to be in a space with other women in prison and not be able to touch each other. Or when we would touch each other, how we would be locked away for touching each other or being with each other intimately in ways in which the police defined it as being unacceptable. So we talked about all of those things, and it's really important to bring women back to their groundedness. You know, it's like having that sacred space and that ability to get in touch with spirit, to get in touch with self, to be fully self-expressed. So out of that, once we did that, we were able to sit down and then start talking about what type of problems that we saw. And we could always talk about the problems. We could always talk about what we felt inside, but then because we were never asked what might be some of the solutions, it was hard to get at that. So then we reframed the problem conversation to the solution conversation. And then once that was reframed and it was okay to talk about the silliest solutions that you might come up with, then we came to real solutions that would change some of the practices and policies. So once we did that, our sisters on the outside began to think about the sisters on the inside. And so how do you bridge the inside and outside communities? Well, you know, we had been doing this work. I'd been doing this work for a long time. So one of the things that I was able to do was to talk to corrections and talk to parole. And I was able to get this information back into the prison. And I was able to get the sisters who had come out and been trained in this to go into the prison and begin to train women inside. And we started a Sister Inside project. So the sisters could write us about things that were happening inside, and we would address it on the outside because we had ways in which we could connect with some of the practices. We would talk to the commissioner and say, we understand that this is going on. And he would say, well, how did you find that out? And we'd just say, well, we knew it was happening. We didn't leave too long, or somebody just came home and they just told us about it. So we wouldn't out our sisters, but we would know what was going on. So the sisters outside and the sisters inside, they started training each other. They continue to train each other in our Rise Up program. And this is, again, to build self-expression, self-esteem, self-empowerment, self-initiative. So one of the questions for the women inside was, like, how could we actually do this work without getting locked up in SHU, the secure housing unit? And so, you know, we would always ask them to not do anything that was too adverse against the practices, but to let us know what was happening so that we could be able to, we would be able to do a little bit more on the outside. But we wanted them to build leadership amongst their sisters inside. We wanted them to train them. We wanted them to begin using their these same practices that we practiced inside with the women about self-expression and gaining voice. Not leaving your sisters behind is important. You have to bridge those two worlds between the sisters on the inside and the outside. Speaking out is really important. That's another aspect. Influencing public opinion through public speaking, media appearances is central for our goal. What we did was we trained women to speak to the media, and we trained them to speak about the problem and the solutions, not about their experiences. So once they were able to put their experience on the side and talk about the problems and the solutions, they felt empowered about what it was that they were talking about. So it wasn't about their story or their experience. It was about what was continuing to happen, and what needed to be changed. And so that really empowered women to be able to feel as if they were a force, you know, when they spoke to the media. So we got folks that were involved in blogs and TV interviews and just print interviews, and we got women that were home and even women that were inside to share their stories and many times be a part of these processes. So public speaking training, policy and legislative trainings, and workshops on personal storytelling for women is important. Supporting new leaders, right? Sometimes some of us that do this work, we don't want to let go of the helm, right? Because we feel like we've been doing it and we're doing it on behalf of people. But once you bring people to a place of where they can talk about what it is that they've experienced and feel empowered, then you need to let them go ahead. You need to show them, you need to give them step-by-step guidelines on how to be an effective leader. You should never just let them kind of wallow or just be out there, hang them dry. You should give them the information that you have and be dedicated to give them the information that you have so that they can lead, because they're going to lead the other sisters that have had this experience, because the other sisters trust them more than they will ever trust you if you've never had the experience. And so you have to think about that. And then you have to think about it. If you have a leader that's in front of them that have experienced the same thing that women have experienced inside, they feel that they can do it too once they see someone else. So if you're bringing someone forward and then they're that role model for the other sisters, and they think that addressing policy and changing legislation is impossible, how could they speak to anyone? They've been incarcerated. You've just alleviated that myth, because now you've helped to support a person in creation of themselves and being able to make change, and that person is a role model for the sisters that are still inside who think that they can't do it. They can now do it. So supporting new leaders is important. Multiple roads to change. There are multiple roads to change. So if you think about organizing from a perspective of doing direct actions, and someone is scared to be out in the public because they feel that they may get arrested, then find something else for them to do where they can use their skills, identify their skills, so that you can actually have them become useful. So there are rallies, lobby days, empowerment workshops, closed door meetings, public officials meetings, open door public hearings. There are many things that folks can be involved in. So the birthing behind bars site, what we've done is we've collected stories. So you'll see the story bank is where we want to collect women's stories on their experience of being incarcerated and shackled and handcuffed. So if you know women, this is a way for them to share their stories, and they can share it in print, video, and audio. So there's many different ways that women, and you can go to the site and see how many women have shared their stories. And there's also a tab on there where we want you to sign on to the petition. We want you to ally with us. We want you to, because the more signatures we have, then the more allies we have, be a champion and make sure that they end shackling. We're expanding this internationally in May, so it's not just specific to New York. We're looking at it from an international perspective. And so why did we choose shackling? Why do you think we chose shackling? It's a no-brainer, right? But we know that women are impacted reproductively. I mean, we have judges that say to women, you're going to serve 20-year sentence because I know you will never have a baby. Judges tell women that all the time that are locked up. You know, we're going to make sure, I'm going to make sure that you never reproduce, right? So we know that women are given misdiagnoses in prison around their reproductive health. We know women are not really medically safe in prison, right? We know that women are not educated during their incarceration. We know that women don't understand and don't feel like they know their rights where they can ask for a second opinion. We know that women have been operated on where they've either been sterilized and or, you know, had operations that were totally unnecessary. So why shackling? Because it's a no-brainer. You can wrap your mind around it, that a woman should not be, you know, shackled during childbirth. And then we can talk about the other issues, you know, but we have to do things in piecemeal because people can only take but so much, you know, unfortunately. You gotta take the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. So I hope, and I know that I went all over the place, so I hope that you ask questions and that you got something from this, and I really appreciate your listening. Thank you.